Hello and welcome to a special edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm your host, Abigail Galvan.
Moving forward at the state level, a look at the major rallies for the unborn in 2025. The president and pro-lifers, the good and bad coming out of the second Trump administration. And a crowning achievement, a closer look at very public pro-life stands made by the monarch of Monaco.
...2025 was a year of milestones for the pro-life movement. This includes a victory in the nation's highest court. In June, the Supreme Court ruled that local Planned Parenthood businesses cannot force state governments to give them Medicaid funds. In their 6-3 decision, the justices said Congress did not create an individual right to the benefits, and thus states are allowed to cut off public funds from abortion providers. EWTN legal analyst Andrea Picotti-Bayer says the Supreme Court is set to weigh in on more pro-life cases in the new year.
You know, obviously, any case that gets to the Supreme Court is a huge case, right? Because it's not just the region where the case originated, the state or the locality, but it's going to have a decision that has implications across the country. And this really shows that, you know, Dobbs was just the beginning. Once we lifted up the kind of juggernaut that abortion had over the Constitution and really did ground ourselves in what the Constitution stands for, we're going to have an uphill battle, continuing to promote life and to push back against people that really want to bring us back to that pre-Dobbs state of America that really was unfair to the Constitution and especially unfair to vulnerable women that are looking for the supports that they need in order to bring life into this world.
The fight for the unborn is also taking place at the state level, and that puts lawmakers and local marches for life in the spotlight. Listen to the energy of that crowd at the Pennsylvania March for Life in Harrisburg. Pro-lifers of all ages joined each other in September on the steps of the state capitol. The Keystone State was just one of 19 states to hold a March for Life in 2025. Each rally typically begins with a concert, followed by speakers, including state lawmakers, church leaders, and other pro-lifers. Marchers would then fill the streets and walk near or around their respective state capital. The head of Ohio's Catholic Conference told EWTN Pro-Life Weekly that a state march is an invitation for those who follow church teaching on the sanctity of life to become more involved.
We've seen the fruit of marchers who come to the state march for life and are Catholic and get more involved in being faithful citizens through the Bishop's Conference, as well as get involved with pregnancy resource centers and similar organizations. So we trust that the movement is building.
In North Dakota, the state's March for Life played out differently from previous years amid rising violence, from the assassination of Charlie Kirk to the targeting of a Catholic grade school by a shooter in Minnesota. Organizers and officials made the difficult decision to cancel the actual march. Still, a mass was held indoors in Bismarck, North Dakota. Bishop David Kagan from the Bismarck Diocese celebrated. After Mass, participants ate lunch, then took part in an indoor rally with music. An official with the Bismarck Diocese says the state's March for Life is not meant to change a viewpoint because North Dakota is heavily pro-life. Instead, it seeks to reaffirm pro-life positions.
We're together in this pro-life movement, and with the students especially, they're the pro-life generation, so we want to make sure that they have, you know, the support from the diocese and the schools.
Mark your calendars. The March for Life has announced its 2026 winter-spring state march schedule. Two new cities were added to the list in Concord, New Hampshire and Helena, Montana. The 2026 summer-fall state march dates will also be announced soon. Stay tuned. Within the first few weeks of President Trump's second term, he pardoned 23 Americans imprisoned for protesting abortion.
Next, we have a set of pardons for peaceful pro-life protesters who were prosecuted by the Biden administration for exercising their First Amendment rights.
Do you know how many?
I believe it's 23, sir.
23 people were prosecuted. They should not have been prosecuted. Many of them are elderly people. They should not have been prosecuted. This is a great honor to sign this.
These pro-life advocates were convicted of violating the Freedom of Access to Clinical Entrances Act, more widely known as the FACE Act. Some are shown here, including Joan Bell, Jonathan Darnell, and Lauren Handy. Both Joan and Lauren have since returned to abortion facilities, advocating for the unborn and counseling women to choose life. There also were victories away from the courtroom. In February, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to ban biological men from women's sports. The president signed the order surrounded by female athletes of all ages. He says the order will protect opportunities for women and girls to compete in safe and fair sports. President Trump also said, quote, "The war on women's sports is over." Federal funding is set to be pulled from schools that do not comply. One expert told us why he applauded the president's move.
It's been almost a decade that we've seen the federal government try to rewrite Title IX, try to force boys who identify into girls, into the girls' locker room and onto the girls' sports teams, despite the fact that the grassroots don't like this. Soccer moms don't like this. Joe the plumber doesn't like this. It's incredibly unpopular. It's like a 70-30, 80-20 issue. And yet the left was insistent on imposing gender ideology on the nation. Thankfully, President Trump has called their bluff, and it's popular with the American people.
Amid the pro-life victories were some defeats and concerns. The Trump administration expanded access to in vitro fertilization, a practice the Catholic Church strongly opposes. One expert says the White House is doing a delicate balancing act. For more, we turn to Emma Waters, policy analyst at the Center for Technology and the Human Person at the Heritage Foundation. Emma, great to be with you. There's a lot to unpack, including why there might be some good news in this announcement. But first, as we mentioned, the Catholic Church strongly opposes in vitro fertilization. How should the faithful react to the president's expansion of IVF?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. And I think we certainly have to begin this conversation recognizing that any expansion of IVF means that there are going to be more human embryos that are created and destroyed every year. Basic estimates that we have, and they're only basic estimates because we don't actually track how many embryos are created every year in the United States, show that as many as 97% of all embryos created in IVF never reach to a live birth, which means that IVF only has around a 3% success rate. And so that tragedy is something that we cannot ignore. And yet at the same time, the president's approach to fulfilling his campaign promise and addressing this IVF report, I think is incredibly brilliant on his part. He has not buddied up to the fertility industry, and this is not boosting the underregulated and unaccountable practices that they're endorsing. But instead, the report did two things. First, it lowered drug costs through the most favored nation status, implicitly implying that fertility industries have been way overcharging Americans for their fertility benefits so far. And then the second is that the plan enables employers to offer fertility benefit packages. And this is where the key opportunity comes in for those who really promote restorative reproductive medicine or root cause restorative treatments for infertility. And so what this means is that employers now have the right and the ability to put together plans that match their sincerely held beliefs, whether that be religious or health related. So if employers at EWTN want to offer a fertility benefit that focuses on root cause care for infertility and reproductive health conditions, that's now something that you can do without any requirement that you cover IVF or any other services like that. And that's a huge opportunity for those who have really been working hard to expand access to better care for men and women.
Now, the Heritage Foundation was among the groups applauding the president's support of fertility treatment, some of which you've mentioned. Can you tell us more about these programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So with restorative reproductive medicine, this is looking at a distinct approach to treating infertility that includes things like monthly cycle charting, sometimes even as much as every day, hormonal treatments, lifestyle and dietary fixes, medical interventions, and even surgical interventions for conditions like endometriosis or blocked fallopian tubes. And so this is a whole person approach that addresses both the health of men and women. And the studies behind it are so encouraging. So four studies that have been done just in the last couple of years alone show that couples who are undergoing treatments for restorative reproductive medicine have anywhere between a 30% and a 50% success rate for having a live birth, having a child. And this means that when they're being treated through restorative reproductive medicine, they are empowered to then have as many children as they desire and the Lord chooses to give them. They don't have to restart an expensive and incredibly difficult process like you do with IVF. So the opportunities here for good root cause care for infertility are huge. And thankfully, the science backs this up. And so this is really an opportunity for so many doctors across the United States and employers to really step up and further expand the care that they've been offering to meet this cultural moment.
Very encouraging. Now, something that's been making the headlines are fertility rates. Just how dire are the fertility rates in the United States? And what advice would you give to White House on improving the birth rate?
You know, there is no single cause for declining birth rates, and they are declining significantly to 1.6 children on average per woman, which is well below the replacement rate of 2.1 children. I mean, this is something that's affecting every aspect of society, but there's not a single thing that we can point to. It's not just finances. It's not just poor housing. It's not just cultural changes. It's all of those things taken together. So I think the big thing that I would encourage the White House and other elected representatives to focus on is one, our emphasis must be on promoting family formation, not just more babies, because ultimately children do best and they're most likely to be more children born when you have an established married family at the heart of this. And that second, that we should really take a whole government approach. So we should be looking at removing any penalties to marriage and children and then promoting the success of families. So improving housing options across the United States, finding creative ways to provide support financially for families who are undergoing the very heroic and self-sacrificial process of having children. And then also continuing to do things like centralizing children in our messaging and cultural conversations. I think the fact that Vice President J.D. Vance brings his children so many places, shows them coming off of Air Force One, messing with their mother's hair at the inauguration, are some of the most humanizing and relatable moments that are really encouraging Americans to think of children as a public good and not just a private burden.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for being with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
A grim milestone this year in Canada. The North American country is nearing the 10th anniversary of legalized assisted suicide. Last year, more than 16,000 people chose to end their lives via assisted suicide. And the Christian Broadcasting Network recently said 4% of those people did not have a terminal diagnosis nor reasonably foreseeable death. One pro-lifer in Canada is working hard to alert people to the dangers of assisted suicide. And Amanda Achtman from Dying to Meet You, a pro-life leader in Canada, joins us now. Amanda, great to be with you. As we mentioned, you say it is not so much a culture of death, but death without culture. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we're losing the cultural tenor around death and dying. We're losing the rituals and the mores, the customs and traditions that pertain to suffering, dying, grieving, and hoping. And that cultural crisis is what has led to our euthanasia crisis here in Canada.
And Amanda, can you tell us more about Dying to Meet You? What are the reactions of people, especially young people, to your work?
I created Dying to Meet You, first of all, as a project of my own catharsis. I was working in the office of a member of parliament a few years ago, trying to prevent the legislative expansion of euthanasia on the basis of disability and mental illness. It was very challenging to be a Christian pro-life political staffer, knowing that this law expanding euthanasia was a foregone conclusion and going to pass anyway. And that inspired me to think, what can I do personally to contribute toward a culture of life in Canada? So I started blogging and having casual conversations every day with Canadians about these topics of end of life and trying to find a humanizing angle that would be edifying and orienting. And since then, I discerned the need to take this project to the next level. So now through writing, speaking, producing short films, and cooperating with different dioceses across Canada, I call them diocesan activation weeks, where a bishop will invite me and I'll give formation and facilitate intergenerational activities across Canada, and increasingly be invited to speak around the world. There's such a need and a hunger to engage these topics, because really not a day goes by that I do not hear about how euthanasia is affecting people personally. And for my generation, I'm a millennial, one of the chief ways that euthanasia is affecting my friends is because they're losing their grandparents to euthanasia. We also know that tens of thousands of Canadians have died by euthanasia, but very few family members speak out. And as I'm seeing in accompanying people who share their story, I'm starting to see why. The reason is because family members are met with the, it's not about you, just get over it. And that is a compounding sorrow, a compounding wound that is so difficult. But I am really determined to come alongside the family members who have been affected and to share to those who might be tempted to euthanasia that this is not a victimless choice. It affects, as Benjamin says in his video, multiple generations.
Amanda, that's really beautiful, and I really applaud you for doing this work. You mentioned you've been working in this movement for a long time and felt the need to start bringing these stories. Since you've started this project, have you seen a lot of change in the people you engage with on this topic?
Many people tell me that they've never thought that deeply about it before, especially many people don't expect euthanasia to touch them until it does. A lot of times people think that euthanasia is restricted for the most marginal of cases, but what I've started to say a bit provocatively, in particular to the older audiences to whom I speak, is don't join the statistic. This is not a way to honor the exceptional life you've lived, because you don't become part of an exceptional cohort in death, but rather a statistic that has contributed to making Canada the euthanasia capital of the world. What we're seeing in Canada is the direct, deliberate ending of life within 15 minutes, reducing a person's death to an appointment that conveniently suits the lives of others. And when people express the desire for it, I do not believe they are so much expressing the desire to die as they are betraying a real disappointment in their heart.
Now, Amanda, you have an interesting faith background with a lot of intersection of Catholic and Jewish traditions. How does your faith play a role in your work?
Well, one of the guiding motivations for my work was the close experience that I had with my grandfather. He was a Polish Jew who thankfully came to Canada just before the Second World War. And I learned growing up that all of the extended family, all of the people with my last name in Europe, perished in the Holocaust. And this really heightened my sensitivity to the value of life and to the precariousness that happens whenever life is at risk of being discarded, dismissed, or discounted. And so euthanasia really represents a crisis of self-harm and self-esteem, but because it predominantly concerns the elderly, we don't always think about it that way. But Pope Francis was always saying that the alliance between old and young will save the human family. And I really felt in the years that I was following Pope Francis's remarks on the meaning and value of aging in scripture, I like to think of it as a theology of aging, that it really encapsulated the precious gift that I had of having my grandfather in my life.
Amanda, if our viewers would like more information, where can they go?
Check out dyingtomeetyou.com. You can see the short films I've released, lots of podcasts, articles, and get in touch with me if you'd like to.
Amanda, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. God bless.
And in Uruguay, church leaders and other pro-life leaders were disappointed after lawmakers there passed a measure that opened the door to legalize euthanasia. Lawmakers applauded the passage of the Death with Dignity bill. It allows anyone over the age of 18 who is suffering from a, quote, chronic or incurable health condition causing unbearable suffering to have access to euthanasia. The Catholic Church strongly opposes assisted suicide. Uruguay is the first South American country to legalize euthanasia through legislation. Soon after the vote, we spoke with South American expert Jason Poblete, who has followed the story closely.
It seems on the patient, and it colors the language saying, oh, this is to make life better. But what it's doing is putting the culture of death ahead of the culture of life, the sanctity of life. And look, and I dealt with this personally, it's very tough when someone's suffering from a chronic illness or disease. We shouldn't be cavalier about it. It's a very serious issue. But the way the Senate in Uruguay antiseptically parsed this out, I think is a wake-up call for all of us. I mean, here in the United States, we have at least 10 states that deal with, not euthanasia, that's still illegal in the United States, but a variant of assisted suicide or suicide legalization. And we have to pay more attention to it, because I think what will happen in South America, for example, is in nearby Chile, who is currently debating a euthanasia bill in the Senate. It's been languishing there for many months now. They've tried to do this many, many times. Could be the next place. But also here in the United States, we have a lot of places where we can talk about as well. But I think it's a wake-up call for all of us, especially in a country like Uruguay, which is predominantly Catholic, with unique laicized characteristics, that we need to be more attention and more focus on the culture battles, talking about this issue, and being bold about defending life from conception until natural death.
Now, you mentioned your personal connection to this story. Can you tell us about that experience you had?
My very first experience with this was many, many years ago. You know, my mom was young by relative when she was in her mid-50s, when she was battling a very difficult illness. Mm-hmm. And we were unprepared for it. And the onus fell on me, and I wasn't prepared for it either. And it was a process that I remember to this day, very antiseptic. The doctor wasn't really equipped to have that conversation with us. But I knew my mother's wishes. So I knew going into whatever they were going to tell me. And I realized very soon what they were trying to tell me, but they wouldn't talk to me about it. Palliative care was not even a conversation. Mm. There was no conversation whatsoever about things that we can do to make her feel more comfortable, to see if she had a fighting chance. My mom was a fighter. She was about 5'6" and had the energy of a 6'2" person. I mean, she was a very, very energetic woman, loved life, and wasn't well served by some of the medical professionals. On the other hand, there were a lot of nurses, a lot of people behind the scenes who made that journey possible. But it kind of was a wake-up call for me, because at that time I was working in Washington and working on Capitol Hill. And I'll share something with you I had not shared with people before. I was in the middle of a background briefing on hospice care and people seeking reimbursement rates. And I saw how life was being reduced to an actuarial table. And I found that very offensive. And I said, you know, in the society we live in, this is easier in hindsight, of course. And this happened in Uruguay, because I've spoken to some lawyers down there and some other people who are involved with the process. Mm-hmm. We have to fight the urge to put a consumer mindset mm-hmm. on life. And we're not disposable. You can't treat mm-hmm. people as disposable. And we have to come out of that mindset quickly. Because in Uruguay, they fell into that trap eons ago. This has been slowly baking. It's been explained to me by Uruguayan jurists that, well, Jason, this didn't just happen 8 years ago. This is a cultural shift that came over time.
Thank you for sharing that very personal story and for sounding the alarm. You mentioned that the culture of death in Uruguay had begun a long time before these legislation was introduced. And I've heard that in Uruguay, Christmas is now officially called Family Day, and the oaths of office no longer include a reference to God. What exactly is happening?
Well, that is an odd, it's a peculiar, it's kind of a peculiarity of Uruguay's political system. Mm. And the role of the Catholic Church is some history that we don't have time to talk about today. But unlike other Latin American nations, Uruguay's Catholic Church was a strong church, but not as strong a church back in, we're going back centuries now. So the culture of the laicized culture was always a strand of their development of their democracy. So when you listen to the debate on between the people who oppose the law, they're always kind of hedging, not necessarily to the religious argument or the sanctity of life argument, but they're always focused more on the democratic debate. Like, so they remove, and they have been removing God from their constitution. They did that a while back. There has been a species of a legal allowance for certain types of death that doesn't criminalize it if under certain conditions. As you said, a lot of the holidays, they'll celebrate Christmas, but it's not really Christmas. It's a laicized holiday. Mm-hmm. Even in the military, the soldiers and airmen, what have you, they're not supposed to bring religion into service.
Coming up, Golden Rulers. The Catholic monarch of Monaco blocks a pro-abortion measure. How this public stand is reminiscent of a move made by a 20th century king. You're watching EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome back. In early December, the Catholic monarch of Monaco took a stand for the unborn by refusing to sign a measure that would have legalized abortion in the Western European city-state. Prince Albert II declined to sign the measure passed by the National Council. The monarch told local media, quote, "The current system expresses who we are, considering the role of our Catholic religion in our country, while ensuring safe and humane support." EWTN Solène Tadier says this public stand by Prince Albert II is reminiscent of a move made by a leader in Belgium in the 1990s.
What is very interesting is that we have very few precedents in Europe, other precedents of this case. It happened in 1990 with King Baudouin of Belgium. I don't know if many will remember that, but in 2024, Pope Francis opened officially a beatification process for King Baudouin for the very reason that he opposes the law of the legalization of abortion in his country in 1990. And he was bypassed by the parliament. He was declared unable to rule the country for 48 hours, and during which the ministers signed the bill without him.
Pope Francis praised the example of King Baudouin, saying he abdicated the throne rather than approve a pro-abortion measure. Lawmakers in Belgium later returned him to power because of his great popularity. King Baudouin died at 1993 at the age of 63. He ruled Belgium for 42 years. I'm excited to share that EWTN News has launched a new YouTube channel. I hope you'll subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of Pro-Life Weekly. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.